Well, good evening, everybody. Hi, boys and girls, and welcome to Reading with Rick on a Friday night. Looks like it's going to be a pretty nice weekend. Do you have a lot of plans? Got some fun activities? I hope so. I think it's going to be really nice out. Tonight, we're going to have a Berenstain Bears story to start off. And they go to a museum tonight. The Berenstain Bears and the Missing Dinosaur Bone. That's going to be our first story tonight. And then since it is Friday night, and on Fridays we have been reading a story that's a little bit for the older kids and the adults. And we finished up with The Red Pony from John Steinbeck last week. So tonight, I decided to go with a great Western tonight. We're going to read about cowboys tonight from the great Western author Louis L'Amour. Tonight's story from Mr. L'Amour is called Dutchman's Flat. So that'll be a fun one. I hope you like Westerns. I do. I really enjoy those. So we'll have that in just a little while. But for now, let's find out about this missing dinosaur bone and the Berenstain Bears. The first picture, they're in the museum and they're looking up at a big skeleton of a dinosaur. It looks like a Tyrannosaurus Rex skeleton, but there's a bone missing from his leg. His foot is there, his foot bones, but his leg is gone. That must be the missing dinosaur bone. And they're lined up at the door outside the Bear Museum. And there's a big sign over the door that says, "See the dinosaur skeleton today at noon." And the clock on the wall says it's 11. So they have an hour to go and they're already bears lining up outside the door. And it looks like the guy who is in charge of the museum, he's peeking out the window, seeing all the bears lined up, and he looks a little worried. There must be something wrong inside. Dr. Bear inside, pacing the floor. "What's wrong in there? What's up? What's up?" wonder three little bears and one little pup. Yeah, Dr. Bear inside, he is pulling his hair out. "There's something really wrong in the museum. A dinosaur bone is missing in there. Somebody took it," said Dr. Bear. "Who took that bone? Who took it? Where?" And he's showing them through the window that, yeah, the leg bone from that dinosaur skeleton is gone. Three little bears and their hound dog Snuff come inside with their detective stuff. There's no case too hard, no case too tough for the bear detectives and their hound dog, Snuff. So they've got their little detective hats on and a spyglass to look for clues and a little bag that says detective kit on it. And coming through the window last is their hound dog, Snuff. Hound dogs are good at sniffing things out, so he might be used to sniff out a clue. And it says, "The search begins, and none too soon, the Bear Museum opens at noon. They will search the place, every cranny and nook. Will they find the bone? Will they find the crook?" They are looking all over the museum, but they don't find it yet. A dark, dark room, a mummy's tomb. Is that the thief, that spooky face? No, that's the museum's mummy case. And it says, "The mummy case of King Grizzly Tut." And it's a big, big mummy case. And on the front of it is a picture of a Grizzly Tut. 11:15, time grows short. Now, where would one hide a bone of that sort? And Dr. Bear, he's looking back at the door, and there's more and more bears waiting to get in. The sign at the door says, "Open at noon." "It could be there, inside that vase, the bone thief's perfect hiding place." And they look at a big vase, and it says, valuable vase. Is that big enough to hide a dinosaur leg bone in it? You can look in that valuable vase if you must. There's nothing in there but some valuable dust. And Dr. Bear grabs the vase and he turns it upside down and all kinds of dust comes flying out. And some of the bears underneath it, they got kind of choked by some of the dust. And Snuff the dog, he is also right in the dust. Not much time left, just half an hour. The bear detectives search the tower. And now the line of bears outside the door to get in stretches all the way up the road and up the hill. There's a bear selling balloons to the people waiting, and they are going up the tower to search for that bone. Boy, you look at that museum, it's pretty fancy. They have a couple of towers. There's some kind of plane there that is on display, and all kinds of rooms and telescopes. As they get to the top of the stairs in the tower, they say, there he is, the thief, and the bone he stole. Wrong again, that's an Indian totem pole. Dr. Bear was behind him, and he turned on the light so they could see. It's getting late, but still they look, and still no bone, and still no crook. Say, maybe bone thieves work in packs, three thieves, with a sword and a gun and an axe. They're looking behind a curtain, and they think they see the thieves standing back there. Wrong again. It's the museum's famous statues of wax. And there are all kinds of characters made out of wax that look so real that they could be real bears, but they're not. There's Blackbeard the Pirate, Wild Bear Hickok, Genghis Bear, and Queen Elizabeth, all made out of wax. They had better find that leg bone soon. There's just 1 minute left till noon. With no more time to search and look, they know they will not catch that crook. They failed. This case is much too hard. And they come down the stairs, and they're not looking too happy. They look pretty sad that they couldn't solve the case of the missing bone. Wait, what's that out there in the yard? They look out the window. That lump of ground, that bone-shaped mound, the missing bone, it's found, it's found. With hound dog paw prints all around. The case is solved. No job's too hard. No case too tough for the bear detectives and that bone thief, Snuff. So it was Snuff that grabbed the bone. And what do dogs do with bones? They bury them. And that's what he had done with that dinosaur bone. But they got it back just in time and put it back in its place. And Dr. Bear opened the doors to the museum and all the bears came in to see that fabulous dinosaur skeleton that had all its bones. What an ending to that story. They found out that it was Snuff that took the bone. And that's the end of that story from the Berenstain Bears. And we ran through every story in this nice book titled The Big Book of Berenstain Bears Beginner Books. We had the bike lesson, we went on a picnic, bear's vacation, they went in the spooky old tree, there were bears in the night, and tonight, the missing dinosaur bone. That was a great collection of Berenstain Bears story. So, Monday, we're going to have to find something new, because we're done with the Berenstain Bears. We'll find some new books for you to enjoy on Monday on Reading with Rick. So we'll take our break now and let you get off to bed, and maybe Mom and Dad will let you stay up a little bit later tonight because it's the weekend. But when we come back, we head out west and Louis L'Amour and his story, Dutchman's Flat. That's coming up next here on Reading with Rick. Thank you. welcome back to Reading with Rick, and tonight we've got a story for you. It's Friday night, and we bring you some stories geared maybe towards a little bit of the older kids and moms and dads and adults as well. So we save those for Friday nights, and here it is Friday. So we're going to go out to the old, old West tonight with great Western author Louis L'Amour. This is an action-packed frontier story, it says. So the name of this story from Louis L'Amour is called Dutchman's Flat. And here we go. The dust of Dutchman's Flat had settled in a gray film upon their faces, and Neil could see the streaks made by the sweat on their cheeks and brows and knew his own must be the same. No man of them was smiling, and they rode with their rifles in their hands, six grim and purposeful men upon the trail of a single rider. They were men shaped and tempered to the harsh ways of a harsh land, strong in their sense of justice, ruthless in their demand for punishment, relentless in pursuit. From the desert they had carved their homes, and from the desert they drew their courage and their code, and the desert knows no mercy. Where's he heading, you reckon? Home, most likely. He'll need grub and a rifle. He's been living on the old Sorensen place. Kimmel spat. He's welcome to it. That place starved out four men I know of. And he stared at the hoof tracks ahead. He's got a good horse. Big buckskin. Reckon we'll catch him, Hardin? Sure. Not this side of his place, though. There ain't no shortcuts we can take to head him off. And he's pointing for home straight as a horse can travel. Ain't trying to cover his trail, none. No use trying. Hardin squinted his eyes against the glare of the sun. He knows we figure he'll head for his ranch. He's no tenderfoot. Kesney expressed the thought that had been drawing upon them all in the last 2 hours. He knows how to save a horse, and he knows a trail. They rode on in near silence. Hardin scratched his unshaven jaw. The dust lifted from the hooves of the horses as they weaved their way through the catclaw and mesquite. It was a parched and sun-baked land, with only dancing heat waves and the blue distance of the mountains to draw them on. The trail they followed led straight as a man could ride across the country. Only at draws or nests of rocks did it swerve, where they noticed the rider always gave his horse the best of it. No rider of the desert must see a man to know him, for it is enough to follow his trail. In these things are the ways of a man made plain, his kindness or cruelty, his ignorance or cunning, his strength and his weakness. There are indications that cannot escape a man who has followed trails, and in the 2 hours since they had ridden out of freedom, the six had already learned much of the man they followed, and they would learn more. What started it? The words sounded empty and alone in the vast stillness of the basin. Hardin turned his head slightly so the words could drift back. It was the manner of a man who rides much in the wind or rain. He shifted the rifle to his left hand and wiped his sweaty right palm on his coarse pants leg. Some loose talk. He was in the Bon Ton, buying grub and such. Johnny said something at which he took offense, and they had some words. Johnny was wearing a gun, but this Locke wasn't, so he gets him a gun and goes over to the Longhorn. He pushes open the door and shoots Johnny twice through the body, in the back. Hardin spat. He fired a third shot, but that missed Johnny and busted a bottle of whiskey. There was a moment's silence while they digested this, and then Neil looked up. We lynching him for the killing or busting the whiskey? It was a good question, but drew no reply. The dignity of the five other riders was not to be touched by humor. They were riders on a mission. Neil let his eyes drift over the dusty copper of the desert. He had no liking for the idea of lynching any man, and he did not know the squatter from Sorensen's place. Living there would be punishment enough for any man. Besides, who saw the shooting? He asked. Nobody seen it, actually, only he never gave Johnny a fair shake. Sam was behind the bar, but he was down to the other end, and it happened so fast. What's his name? Somebody call him Locke? Neil asked. There was something incongruous in lynching a man whose name you did not know. He shifted in the saddle, squinting his eyes toward the distant lakes dancing in the mirage of heat waves. What's it matter? Locke, his name is. Chat Locke. Funny name. The comment drew no response. The dust was thicker now, and Neil pulled his bandana over his nose and mouth. His eyes were drawn back to the distant blue of the lakes. They were enticingly cool and beautiful, lying across the way, ahead and in the basin off to the right. This was the mirage that lured many a man from his trail to pursue the always retreating shoreline of the lake. It looked like water. It really did. Maybe there was water in the heat waves. Maybe, if a man knew how, he could extract it and drink. The thought drew his hand to his canteen, but he took it away without drinking. The slosh water in the canteen was no longer enticing, for it was warm, brackish, and unsatisfying. "You know him, Kimmel?" Kesney asked. He was a wiry little man, hard as a whipstock, with bits of sharp steel for eyes and brown muscle-corded hands. "I wouldn't know him if I saw him." "Sure, I know him. Big feller, strong made, rusty like hair, and maybe 40 years old. Looks plumb salty, too, and from what I hear, he's no friendly sort of man. Squatting on that Sorensen place looks plumb suspicious, for no man can make him a living on that dry-as-a-bone place. No fit place for man nor beast. Everybody figures no honest man would squat on such a place." It seemed a strange thing to be searching out a man whom none of them really knew. Of course, they had all known Johnny Webb. He was a handsome, popular young man, a daredevil and a hellion, but a very attractive one and a top hand to boot. They had all known him and had all liked him. Then, one of the things that made him so sure that this had been a wrong killing, even aside from the shots in the back, was the fact that Johnny Webb had been the fastest man in the Spring Valley country, fast and a dead shot. Johnny had worked with all these men, and they were good men, hard men, but good. Kimmel, Hardin, and Kesney had all made something of their ranches, as had the others, only somewhat less so. They had come west when the going was rough, fought Indians and rustlers, and then battled drought, dust, and hot, hard winds. It took a strong man to survive in this country, and they had survived. He, Neil, was the youngest of them all and newest in the country. He was still looked upon with some reserve. He'd been here only 5 years. Neil could see the tracks of the buckskin, and it gave him a strange feeling to realize that the man who rode that horse would soon be dead, hanging from a noose in one of those ropes attached to a saddle horn of Hardin or Kimmel. Neil had never killed a man or seen one killed by another man, and the thought made him uncomfortable. Yet Johnny was gone, and his laughter and his jokes were a thing past. They had brightened more than one roundup, more than one bitter day of heartbreaking labor on the range. Not that he'd been an angel. He'd been a proper hand with a gun and could throw one. And in his time, he'd had his troubles. "He's walking his horse," Kesney said, leading him. "He's a heavy man," Hardin agreed, "and he figures to give us a long chase." "Gone lame on him, maybe," Kimmel suggested. "No, that horse isn't limping. This lock is a smart one." They had walked out of the ankle-deep dust now and were crossing a parched, dry plain of crusted earth. Hardin reined in suddenly and pointed. "Look there!" He indicated a couple of flecks on the face of the earth crust where something had spilled. Water splashed. "Careless," Neil said. "He'll need that water." "No," Chesney said. "He was pouring water in a cloth to wipe out his horse's nostrils. Bet you a dollar." "Sure," Hardin agreed. "That's it. Horse breathes a lot better. A man running could kill a good horse on this flat. He knows that." They rode on, and for almost a half hour no one spoke. Neil frowned at the sun. It had been on his left a few minutes ago, and now they rode straight into it. "What's he doing?" Kesney said wonderingly. "This ain't the way to his place." The trail had turned again, and now the sun was on their right. Then it turned again and was at their backs. Hardin was in the lead, and he drew up and swore wickedly. They ranged alongside him and stared down into a draw that cracked the face of the desert alongside the trail they had followed. Below them was a place where a horse had stood, and across the bank something white fluttered from the parched clump of greasewood. Kesney slid from the saddle and crossed the wash. When he had the slip of white, he stared at it, and then they heard him swear. He walked back and handed it to Hardin. They crowded near. Neil took the slip from Hardin's fingers after he had read it. It was torn from some sort of book, and the words were plain enough, scrawled with a flat rock for a rest. That was a fair shooting anyways. Six ain't nowhere's enough. Go fetch more men. Man on the grave better tighten his girth or he'll have him a sore-backed hoss. Why that? Short swore softly. He was lying within 50 yards of us when he came by. Had him a rifle, too. I seen it in a saddle scabbard on that buckskin in town. He could have got one of us anyway. Two or three, most likely, Kimmel commented. The men stared at the paper, then looked back into the wash. The sand showed a trail, but cattle had walked here, too. It would make the going a little slower. Neil, his face flushed and his ears red, was tightening his saddle girth. The others avoided his eyes. The insult to him, even if the advice was good, was an insult to them all. Their jaws tightened. The squatter was playing Indian with them, and none of them liked it. Fair shooting, yeah, Sutter exploded right in the back. The trail led down to the wash now, and it was slower going. The occasional puffs of wind they had left on the desert above were gone, and in the heat of the bottom of the wash was oven-like. They rode into it, almost seeming to push their way through flames that seared. Sweat dripped into their eyes until they smarted and trickled in tiny rivulets through their dust-caked beards, making their faces itch maddeningly. The wash spilled out into a wide, flat bed of sand left by the rains of bygone years, and the tracks were plainer now. Neil tightened his bandana and rode on, sodden with heat and weariness. The trail seemed deliberately to lead them into the worst regions, for now he was riding straight toward an alkali lake that loomed ahead. At the edge of the water, the trail vanished. Locke had ridden right into the lake. They drew up and stared at it, unbelieving. "He can't cross," Hardin stated flatly. "That's deep out to the middle. Turned treacherous, too. A horse could get bogged down mighty easy." They skirted the lake, taking it carefully, three going one way, three the other. Finally, glancing back, Neil caught sight of Kesney's uplifted arm. "They found it," he said. "Let's go back." Yet as he rode, he was thinking what they all knew. This was a delay, for Locke knew they would have to scout the shores both ways to find his trail, and there would be a delay while the last three rejoined the first. A small thing, but in such a chase, it was important. "Why not ride right onto the ranch?" Short suggested. "We might," Hardin speculated. "On the other hand, he might fool us and never go nigh it. Then we could lose him." The trail became easier, for now Locke was heading straight into the mountains. "Where's he going?" Kesney demanded irritably. "This don't make no sense, nohow." There was no reply. The horsemen stretched out in single file, riding up the draw into the mountains. Suddenly, Kimmel, who was now in the lead, drew up. Before him, a thread of water trickled from the rock and spilled into a basin of stones. "Huh," Hardin stared. "I never knowed about this spring afore. Might as well have a drink," and he swung down. They all got down, and Neil rolled a smoke. "Somebody sure fixed her up nice," he said. "That wall of stone making that basin ain't so old." "No, it ain't." Short watched them drink and grinned. "He's a fox, right enough. He's an old Ladino, this one. A regular mossy horn. It don't take no time for one man to drink and one hoss, but here we got six men and six horses to drink, and we lose more time." "You really think he planned it that way?" Neil said, skeptical. Hardin looked around at him. "Sure, this Locke knows his way around." When they were riding on, Neil thought about that. Locke was shrewd. He was desert wise, and he was leading them a chase. If not even Hardin knew of this spring, and he had been 20 years in the Spring Valley country, then Locke must know a good deal about the country. Of course, this range of mountains was singularly desolate, and there was nothing in them to draw a man. So they knew this about their quarry. He was a man wise in the ways of desert and trail, and one who knew the country. Also, Neil reflected, it was probable he had built that basin himself. Nobody lived over this way but Locke, for now it was not far to the Sorensen place. Now they climbed a single horse trail across the starkly eroded foothills, sprinkled with clumps of Joshua and Spanish bayonet. It was a weird and broken land where long fingers of black lava stretched down the hills and out into the desert as though clawing toward the alkali lake they left behind. The trail mounted steadily, and a little breeze touched their cheeks. Neil lifted his hand and wiped dust from his brow, and it came away in flakes, plastered by sweat. The trail doubled and changed, now across the rock face of the burnt red sandstone, then into the lava itself, skirting hills where the exposed ledges mounted in layers like a vast cake of many colors. Then the way dipped down, and they wound among huge boulders, smooth as so many water-worn pebbles. Neil sagged in the saddle, for the hours were growing long, and the trail showed no sign of ending. "Lucky he ain't waiting to shoot," Kimmel commented, voicing the first remark in over an hour. "He could pick us off like flies." As if in reply to his comment, there was an angry whine above them, and then the crack of a rifle. As one man, they scattered for shelter, whipping rifles from their scabbards, for all but two had replaced them when they reached the lake. Hardin swore, and Kimmel wormed his way to a better view of the country ahead. Short had left the saddle in his scramble for shelter, and his horse stood in the open, the canteen making a large lump behind the saddle. Suddenly, the horse leaped to the solid thud of a striking bullet, and then followed the crack of the rifle echoing over the mountainside. Short swore viciously, if he killed that horse, but the horse, while shifting nervously, seemed uninjured. "Hey," Kesney yelled, "he shot your canteen." And it was true enough. Water was pouring onto the ground, and swearing Short started to get up, but Souter grabbed his arm. "Hold it. If he could get that canteen, he could get you." They waited, and the trickle of water slowed, then faded to a drip. All of them stared angrily at the unrewarding rocks ahead of them. One canteen the less. Still, they had all filled up at the spring and should have enough. Uncomfortably, however, they realized that the object of their chase, the man called Chat Locke, knew where he was taking them, and he had not emptied that canteen by chance. Now they understood the nature of the man they followed. He did nothing without object. Lying on the sand or rocks, they waited, peering ahead. "He's probably riding off now," Sutter barked. Nobody showed any disposition to move. The idea appealed to none of them, for the shot into the canteen showed plainly enough the man they followed was no child with a rifle. Kimmel finally put his hat on a rifle muzzle and lifted it. There was no response. Then he tried sticking it around a corner. Nothing happened, and he withdrew it. Almost at once, a shot hit the trail not far from where the hat had been. The indication was plain. Locke was warning them not only that he was still there, but that he was not to be fooled by so obvious a trick. They waited, and Hardin suddenly slid over a rock and began a flanking movement. He crawled, and they waited, watching his progress. The cover he had was good, and he could crawl almost to where the hidden marksman must be. Finally, he disappeared from their sight, and they waited. Neil tasted the water in his canteen and dozed. At last, they heard a long yell, and looking up, they saw Hardin standing on a rock far up the trail, waving them on. Mounting, they led Hardin's horse and rode up on the trail. He met them at the trail side. His eyes were angry. "Gone," he said, thrusting out a hard palm. In it lay three brass cartridge shells. "Found 'em standing up in a line on a rock. And look here." He pointed, and they stared down at the trail where he indicated. A neat arrow made of stones pointed down the trail ahead of them, and scratched on the face of the sandstone above it were the words, "Follow the signs." Kesney jerked his hat from his head and hurled it to the ground. "Why, that dirty—" and he stopped, beside himself with anger. The contempt of the man they pursued was obvious. He was making fools of them, deliberately teasing them, indicating his trail as to a child or a tenderfoot. "That ratty back-shooting killer," Short said. "I'll take pleasure in using a rope on him. Thinks he's smart." They started on, and the horse ahead of them left a plain trail. But a quarter of a mile further along, three dried pieces of mesquite had been laid in the trail to form another arrow. Neil stared at it. This was becoming a personal matter now. He was deliberately playing with them, and he must know how that would set with men such as Kimmel and Hardin. It was a deliberate challenge. More, it was a sign of the utmost contempt. The vast emptiness of the basin they skirted now was becoming lost in the misty purple light of late afternoon. On the right, the wall of the mountain grew steeper and turned a deeper red. The burnt red of the earlier hours was now a bright rust red, and here and there long fingers of quartz shot their white arrows down into the face of the cliff. They all saw the next message, but all read and averted their eyes. It was written on a blank face of the cliff. First, there was an arrow pointing ahead, and then the words, "Shade, so as you don't get sunstroke." They rode on, and for several miles, as the shadows drew down, they followed the markers their quarry left at intervals along the trail. All six of the men were tired and beaten. Their horses moved slowly, and the desert air was growing chill. It had been a long chase. Suddenly, Kimmel and Kesney, who rode side by side, reined in. A small wall of rock was across the trail, and an arrow pointed downward into a deep cleft. "What do you think, Hardin? He could pick us off man by man." Hardin studied the situation with misgivings and hesitated, lighting the smoke. "He ain't done it yet." Neil's remark fell into the still air like a rock into a calm pool of water. As the rings of ripples spread wider into the thoughts of the other five, he waited. Lot could have killed one or two of them, perhaps all of them by now. Why had he not? Was he waiting for darkness and an easy getaway, or was he leading them into a trap? "The devil with it," Hardin exclaimed impatiently. He wheeled his horse and, pistol in hand, started down into the narrow rift in the dark. One by one they followed. The darkness closed around them, and the air was damp and chill. They rode on, and then the trail mounted steeply toward a grayness ahead of them, and they came out in a small basin. Ahead of them they heard a trickle of running water and saw the darkness of trees. Cautiously they approached. Suddenly they saw the light of a fire. Hardin drew up sharply and slid from his horse. The others followed. In a widening circle they crept toward the fire. Kesney was the first to reach it, and the sound of his swearing rent the stillness and shattered it like thin glass. They swarmed in around him. The fire was built close beside a small running stream, and nearby was a neat pile of dry sticks. On a paper laid out carefully on a rock was a small mound of coffee and another of sugar. Nobody said anything for a minute, staring at the fire and the coffee. The taunt was obvious, and they were bitter men. It was bad enough to have a stranger make such fools of them on a trail to treat them like tenderfeet, but to prepare a camp for them? "I'll be cussed if I will," Short said violently. "I'll go to sleep on the desert first." "Well," Hardin was philosophical, "might as well make the most of it. We can't trail them at night, no way." Kimmel had dug a coffee pot out of his pack and was getting water from the stream, which flowed from a basin just above their camp. Several of the others began to dig out grub, and Kesney sat down glumly, staring into the fire. He started to pick a stick off the pile left for them, and then jerked his hand as though he'd seen a snake. Getting up, he stalked back into the trees, and after a minute he returned. Sutter was looking around, and suddenly he spoke. "Boys, I know this place, only I never knew about that crack in the wall. This here's the Mormon Well." Hardin sat up and looked around. "Derned if it ain't," he said. "I ain't been in here for 6 or 7 years." Sutter squatted on his haunches. "Look!" He was excited and eager, sketching with a stick in the sand. "Here's Mormon Well, where we are. Right over here to the northwest, there's an old sawmill and a tank just above it. I'll bet a side of beef that derned killer is holed up for the night in that sawmill." Kesney, who had taken most to heart the taunting of the man they pursued, was on his knees staring at the diagram drawn into the damp sand, and he was nodding thoughtfully. "He's right. He sure is. I remember that old mill. I holed up there one time in a bad storm. Spent 2 days in it. If that sidewinder stays there tonight, we can get him." As they ate, they talked over their plan. Traveling over the rugged mountains ahead of them was almost impossible in the darkness, and besides, even if Locke could go the night without stopping, his horse could not. The buckskin must have a rest. Moreover, with all the time Locke had been losing along the trail, he could not be far ahead. It stood to reason that he must have planned just for this, for them to stop here and to hole up in the sawmill himself. "We'd better surprise him," Hardin suggested. That sawmill is heavy timber, and a man in there with a rifle and plenty of ammunition could stand us off for a week. Has he got plenty? Sure he has, Neil told him. I was in the Bon Ton when he bought his stuff. He's got grub and he's got plenty of 44s. They do for either his Colt or his Winchester. Unspoken as yet, but present in the mind of each man, was a growing respect for their quarry, a respect and an element of doubt. Would such a man as this shoot another in the back? The evidence against him was plain enough, or seemed plain enough. Yet beyond the respect, there was something else, for it was no longer simply a matter of justice to be done, but a personal thing. Each of them felt in some measure that his reputation was at stake. It had not been enough for Locke to leave an obvious trail, but he must leave markers, the sort to be used for any tenderfoot. There were men in this group who could trail a wood tick through a pine forest. Well, Kimmel said reluctantly and somewhat grimly, he left us good coffee anyway. They tried the coffee and agreed. Few things in this world are so comforting and so warming to the heart as hot coffee on a chilly night over a campfire when the day has been long and weary. They drank and they relaxed. And as they relaxed, the seeds of doubt began to sprout and put forth branches of speculation. He could have gotten more than one of us today, Sutter hazarded. This one is brushwise. I'll pull that rope on him, Short stated positively. No man makes a fool out of me. But in his voice there was something lacking. You know, Kesney suggested, if he knows these hills like he seems to, and if he really wanted to lose us, we'd have to burn the stump and sift the ashes before we found him. There was no reply. Hardin drew back and eased the leg of his pants away from the skin, for the cloth had grown too hot for comfort. Short tossed a stick from the neat pile into the fire. That mill ain't so far away, he suggested. Shall we give her a try? Later, Hardin leaned back against a log and yawned. She's been a hard day. Both of them bullets go in Johnny's back? The question moved them like a ghost. Short stirred uneasily, and Kesney looked up and glared around. Sure they did, didn't they, Hardin? Sure, he paused thoughtfully. Well, no, one of them was under his left arm, right between the ribs. Looked like a heart shot to me. The other one went through near his spine. The heck with it, Kesney declared. No slick rustling squatter can come into this country and shoot one of our boys. He was shot in the back, and I'd seen both holes. Johnny got that one nigh in the spine, and he must have turned and tried to draw, and then got that other bullet through the heart. Nobody had seen it. Neil remembered that, and the thought rankled. Were they doing an injustice? He felt like a traitor at the thought, but secretly he had acquired a strong tinge of respect for the man they followed. The fire flickered and the shadows danced a slow, rhythmic quadrille against the dark background of trees. He peeled bark from the log beside him and fed it into the fire. It caught, sparked brightly, and popped once or twice. Hardin leaned over and pushed the coffee pot near the coals. Kesney checked the loads in his Winchester. How far to that sawmill, Hardin? About 6 miles, away we go. Let's get started. Short got to his feet and brushed off the sand. I want to get home. Got my boys building fence. You either keep a close watch or they're off gal hooting over the hills. They tightened their saddle girths, doused the fire, and mounted up. With Hardin in the lead once more, they moved off into the darkness. Neil brought up the rear. It was damp and chill among the cliffs and felt like the inside of a cavern. Overhead, the stars were very bright. Mary was going to be worried, for he was never home so late, nor did he like leaving her alone. He wanted to be home, eating a warm supper and going to bed in the old four-poster with the patchwork quilt Mary's grandmother had made pulled over him. What enthusiasm he had had for the chase was gone. The warm fire, the coffee, his own weariness, and the growing respect for Locke had changed him. Now they all knew he was not the manner of man they had supposed. Justice can be a harsh taskmaster, but Western men knew their kind, and the lines were strongly drawn. When you've slept beside a man on the trail, worked with him and with others like him, you come to know your kind. In the trail of the man Chat Locke, each rider of the posse was seen the sort of man he knew, the sort he could respect. The thought was nagging and unsubstantial, but each of them felt a growing doubt, even Short and Kesney, who were most obdurate and resentful. They knew how a back shooter lived and worked. He'd had his brand on everything he did. The mark of this man was the mark of a man who did things, who stood upon his own 2 feet, and who, if he died, died facing his enemy. To the unknowing, such conclusions might seem doubtful, but the men of the desert knew their kind. The mill was dark and silent, a great looming bulk beside the stream and the still pool of the mill pond. They dismounted and eased close. Then, according to a prearranged plan, they scattered and surrounded it. From behind a lodgepole pine, Hardin called out, "We're coming in, Locke! We want you!" The challenge was harsh and ringing. Now that the moment had come, something of the old suspense returned. They listened to the water babbling as it trickled over the old dam, and then they moved. At the first step, they heard Locke's voice. "Don't you come in here, boys. I don't want to kill none of you. But you come, and I will. That was a fair shooting. You got no call to come after me." Hardin hesitated, chewing his mustache. "You shot him in the back," he yelled. "No such thing. He was a-facing the bar when I come in. He seen I was healed, and he drawed as he turned. I beat him to it. My first shot took him in the side, and he was knocked back against the bar. My second hit him in the back, and the third missed as he was a-fallen. You hombres didn't see that right." The sound of his voice trailed off, and the water chuckled over the stones and then sighed to a murmur among the trees. The logic of Locke's statement struck them all. It could have been that way. A long moment passed, and then Hardin spoke up again. "You come in, and we'll give you a trial, fair and square." "How?" Locke's voice was a challenge. "You ain't got no witness, neither have I. Ain't nobody to say what happened there but me, as Johnny ain't alive." "Johnny was a mighty good man, and he was our friend," Short shouted. "No murdering squatter is going to move into this country and start shooting folks up." There was no reply to that, and they waited, hesitating a little. Neil leaned disconsolately against the tree where he stood. After all, Locke might be telling the truth. How did they know? There was no use hanging a man unless you were sure. "Gab!" Short's comment was explosive. "Let's move in. Hardin, let's get him. He's lying. Nobody could beat Johnny. We know that." "Webb was a good man in his own country," Locke shouted in reply. The momentary silence that followed held them, and then, almost as a man, they began moving in. Neil did not know exactly when or why he started. Inside, he felt sick and empty. He was fed up on the whole business, and every instinct told him this man was no back shooter. Carefully they moved, for they knew this man was handy with a gun. Suddenly, Hardin's voice rang out. "Hold it, men. Stay where you are until daybreak. Keep your eyes open and your ears. If he gets out of here, he'll be lucky, and in the daylight we can get him or fire the mill." Neil sank to a sitting position behind a log. Relief was a great warmth that swept over him. There wouldn't be any killing tonight. Not tonight, at least. Yet as the hours passed, his ears grew more and more attuned to the darkness. A rabbit rustled, a pine cone dropped from a tree, the wind stirred high in the pine tops, and the few stars winked through, lonesomely peering down upon the silent men. With daylight, they moved in, and they went through the doors and up to the windows of the old mill, and it was empty and still. They stared at each other, and Short swore viciously, the sound booming in the echoing empty room. "Let's go down to the Sorensen place," Kimmel said. "He'll be there." And somehow they were all very sure he would be. They knew he would be because they knew him for their kind of man. He would retreat no further than his own ranch, his own hearth. There, if they were to have him and hang him, they would have to burn him out, and men would die in their process. Yet with these men, there was no fear. They felt the drive of duty, the need for maintaining some law in this lonely desert and mountain land. There was only doubt which had grown until each man was shaken with it. Even Short, whom the markers by the trail had angered, and Kesney, who was the best tracker among them, even better than Hardin, had been irritated by it too. The sun was up and warming them when they rode over the brow of the hill and looked down into the parched basin where the Sorensen place lay. But it was no parched basin. Hardin drew up so suddenly his startled horse almost reared. It was no longer the Sorensen place. The house had been patched and rebuilt, the roof had spots of new lumber upon it, and the old pole barn had been made watertight and strong. A new corral had been built, and to the right of the house was a fenced-in garden of vegetables, green and pretty, after the desert of the day before. Thoughtfully, and in a tight cavalcade, they rode down the hill. The stock, they saw, was fat and healthy, and the corral was filled with horses. "Been a lot of work done here," Kimmel said, and he knew how much work it took to make such a place attractive. "Don't look like no killer's place," Neil burst out. Then he flushed and drew back, embarrassed by his statement. He was the youngest of these men and the newest in the country. No response was forthcoming. He had but stated what they all believed. There was something stable and lasting and something real and genuine in this place. "I've been waiting for you." This remark came from behind them, and it stiffened every spine. Chat Locke was there, behind them, and he would have a gun on them, and if one of them moved, he could die. "My wife's down there fixing breakfast. I told her I had some friends coming in, a posse hunting a killer. I've told her nothing about this trouble. You ride down there now, you keep your guns, you eat your breakfast, and then if you feel bound or determined to get somebody for a fair shooting, I'll come out with any of you, or all of you, but I ain't going to hang. I ain't naming no one man because I don't want to force no fight on nobody. You ride down there now." They rode, and in the dooryard they dismounted. Neil turned then and for the first time saw Chat Locke. He was a big man, compact and strong. His rusty brown hair topped a brown, sun-hardened face. But with the warmth in his eyes, it was a friendly sort of face, not at all what he expected. Hardin looked at him. "You made some changes here." "I reckon," Locke gestured toward the well. "Dug by hand. My wife worked the windlass." He looked around at them, taking them in with one sweep of his eyes. "I got the grandest woman in the world." Neil felt hot tears in his eyes suddenly and busied himself loosening his saddle girth to keep the others from seeing. That was the way he felt about his Mary. The door opened suddenly and they turned. The sight of a woman in this desert country was enough to make any man turn. What they saw was not what they expected. She was young, perhaps in her middle 20s, and she was pretty, with brown wavy hair and gray eyes and a few freckles on her nose. "Won't you come in? Chat told me you had some friends coming in for breakfast, and it ain't often we have anybody in." Heavy-footed and shamefaced, they walked up on the porch. Kesney saw the care and neatness with which the hard-hewn planks had been fitted. Here, too, was the same evidence of lasting, of performance, of strength. This was the sort of a man a country needed. He thought the thought before he fixed his attention on it, and then he flushed. Inside, the room was as neat as the girl herself. How did she get the floor so clean? Before he thought, he phrased the question. She smiled. "Oh, that was Chet's idea. He made a frame and fastened a piece of pumice stone to a stick. It cuts into all the cracks and keeps them very clean." The food smelled good, and when Hardin looked at his hands, Chat motioned to the door. "There's water and towels if you want to wash up." Neil rolled up his sleeves and dipped his hands in the basin. The water was soft, and that was rare in this country, and the soap felt good on his hands. When he had dried his hands, he walked in. Hardin and Kesney had already seated themselves, and Locke's wife was pouring coffee. "Men," Locke said, "this is Mary. You'll have to tell her your names. I reckon I missed them." "Mary." Neil looked up. She was Mary, too. He looked down at his plate again and ate a few bites. When he looked up, she was smiling at him. "My wife's name is Mary," he said. "She's a fine girl." "She would be, but why don't you bring her over? I haven't talked with a woman in so long I wouldn't know how it seemed. Chat, why haven't you invited them over?" And Chat mumbled something, and Neil stared at his coffee. The men ate in uncomfortable silence. Hardin's eyes kept shifting around the room. That pumice stone, he'd have to fix up a deal like that for Jane. She was always fussing about the work of keeping a board floor clean. That washstand inside, too, with pipes made of hollow logs to carry the water out, so she wouldn't have to be running back and forth. That was an idea, too. They finished their meal reluctantly. One by one, they trooped outside, avoiding each other's eyes. Chat Locke did not keep them waiting. He walked down among them. "If there's to be shooting," he said quietly, "let's get away from the house." Hardin looked up. "Locke, was that right, what you said in the mill? Was it a fair shooting?" Locke nodded. It was. Johnny Webb prodded me. I didn't want trouble, nor did I want to hide behind the fact I wasn't packing an iron. I walked over to the saloon, not aiming for trouble. I aimed to give him a chance if he wanted it. He drawed and I beat him. It was a fair shooting. All right, Harden nodded. That's good enough for me. I reckon you're a different sort of man than any of us figured. Let's mount up, Short said. I got fence to build. Chat Locke put his hand on Harden's saddle. You folks come over sometime. She gets right lonesome. I don't mind it so much, but you know how women folks are. Sure, Harden said. Sure thing. And you bring your Mary over, he told Neil. Neil nodded, his throat full. As they mounted the hill, he glanced back. Mary Locke was standing in the doorway, waving to them, and the sunlight was very bright in the clean-swept dooryard. And that is Dutchman's Flat by Louis L'Amour. Good story. Good Western on a Friday night. Maybe you're sitting around a campfire. Have a great weekend. We'll talk to you again on Monday, 7:30 again. We'll be back with another episode of Reading with Rick here on You Are There Sports. Good night, everybody.